mustn't allow scientific progress to decline. The rapid speed of this progress is essential for us. The country must move forward in science. The country must also advance militarily, and by God's grace, our military personnel are working diligently day and night. God willing, we will make even further advancements. By God's grace, the country will be able to show that it's a strong nation, and no power, regardless of its capabilities, will be able to force the Iranian nation to surrender or bring it to its knees. Almighty God will help us. Strengthen your connections with God through prayer, the Quran, and by becoming acquainted with the truths of religion. Get help from divine assistance and create a better future for yourselves and for the nation, God willing. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Good evening to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. We'll start off this hour's programs with a spotlight. After that, we have To My Brother. The program examines the universal principles contained in the teachings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and their importance for contemporary individuals and societies. Then it's time for our radio productions feature. And we round up this hour's programs with Hadith of the Day. This program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The ceasefire between Israel and Gaza faces a critical test. Hamas has rejected any discussion of phase two negotiations as illegitimate, while accusing Israel of breaching the agreement and disregarding its obligations. The controversial Yellow Line declaration is cited as evidence that Israel is not honoring the deal. Hamas insists that before any further talks can proceed, phase one must be fully implemented, a complete cessation of Israeli killings, the opening of humanitarian aid corridors, and the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. The fate of the ceasefire now hinges on whether these demands are met or whether mistrust and violations will push both sides back into open conflict. Welcome to Spotlight. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with a report.
The US-led peace process for Gaza faces a crisis of credibility. President Trump insists on launching phase two of his plan soon, involving international forces and a new governance council. For him, the phase is already underway, but on the ground, the core commitments of phase one are shattered.
President Trump, can you tell us when phase two of the negotiations will begin?
Well, it started. I mean, it started as far as we're concerned. Phase two has started. And, you know, the phases are all a little bit mixed in with each other. You're going to start cleaning up. You look at Gaza, and it's a lot of cleanup.
Israeli occupation forces have declared they are not going to withdraw. They have solidified control over a massive yellow line interior zone, annexing over 55% of Gaza's territory for what Israeli Army Chief of Staff Erel Zami calls a new border. Inside this occupied area, home demolitions continue. Outside it, Palestinians are shot. Almost 740 Israeli violations have resulted in the death of nearly 390 Palestinians since the ceasefire began. Hamas has strongly rejected the launching of phase two. Senior official Hussam Badran says any talk of phase two is illegitimate while Israel continues to breach the agreement and disregards its obligations. Hamas condemned the Yellow Line declaration as proof that the regime does not honor the deal. The resistance movement demands full implementation of phase one, including a complete stop to killings, open aid corridors, and Israeli occupation forces withdrawal before any new discussions. For Palestinians, phase one's humanitarian, political, and military promises remain unfulfilled. Would Israeli forces pull out of Gaza as required by phase one, or would they continue to violate the truce by killing more Palestinians in Gaza and keeping their land under occupation?
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Reza Veda, the academic researcher and author, joining us from London. And Mick Napier, co-founder of a Scottish-Palestine solidarity campaign, joining us from Glasgow. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the programme. I'm going to start with Mick right now. Well, why does Hamas consider phase two negotiations illegitimate at this stage?
Because everything that Israel committed to do on paper under pressure from Mr. Trump, they violated. And you can see that in the detail today and over the last couple of weeks. But more importantly, you can see it in the entire history of the Zionist project. And if you think about it, if there's a conflict between two sides, Cambodia and Thailand or other, you know, Ukraine, Russia, and so on, a negotiated settlement is possible. In fact, it usually happens after a war. But that's not the situation for the Palestinians. The Zionist project doesn't involve the idea of negotiating with Palestinians because they are slated for disappearance. You don't negotiate with people whom, at the end of the day, you will simply expel. And so anything that Israel commits to paper is only a holding operation until the next offensive. And that's what we've seen in Gaza. It's no surprise to anyone who looks at the entire history. If you look at the Oslo Agreement, Israel violated the terms of the Oslo Agreement from the very start. So that's what we're looking at. It's shocking, but not remotely surprising to anyone who's looked at Israeli history. And in a sense, the Israelis can't possibly treat the Palestinians as equals. If even Netanyahu, in a parallel universe, decided to do that, behind him, the Zionist project, the genocidal state over 70 years, has created Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and so on, and they would simply bring the government down. So the commitment to ongoing ethnic cleansing up till the present day, the yellow line, Israel decides to hold on to it rather than vacate, this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone.
Right, Reza, I want to talk to you about the other side of this deal. The Israelis are pressuring and insisting on moving forward despite not fulfilling any part of the phase one completely. How can that be justified, this demand?
can't be justified. The whole operation of this peace or ceasefire that is not really a ceasefire. We look at Israel has a habit of going around the region, signing up to ceasefires, but not then agreeing to it and breaking them. We know that in south of Lebanon, since they apparently came to ceasefire with Hezbollah, they've broken it 1,000 times, either through military incursions by air or by land. And since the ceasefire in Palestine, in Gaza, they've broken it nearly 1,000 times. They've bombed women, men, children, tents. They haven't allowed tents to come in. So their plan is to starve and kill the Palestinians. They show the facade, and that whole Donald Trump peace summit that invited Indonesian prime minister, president, and heads of other states was just for show. It was just an illusion, a control of the narrative to make the people around the world think there is some kind of a peace. But in reality, it was the slow genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Right. I want to focus on the accusations of breach by the Israeli forces now, Mick. What specific obligations does Hamas claim Israel has disregarded?
I'm not sure of the detail of this, but one of them was to withdraw. And now we hear the head of the military saying that they will entrench themselves behind on the yellow line and not give up an inch of it. As your other guest says, there's a long history of Israel showing that for them to sign a deal means absolutely nothing if in the balance of power shifts in their direction. So there are other commitments as well to release Palestinian prisoners and so on. But Israel can never be trusted to follow any of those. And the statement from the head of the military that they're going to see the yellow line as a new border is not just a violation of what was signed. It's so obvious, it's undeniable, it cannot be seen as anything else by any sensible person, but that's what Israel is doing. For them, it's always been that might equals right, that if they have the power to do something, to violate, to assault, to attack, to dispossess, they will do so in their own, you know, in their own time. They're very alert to international pressure, real pressure, and if that were to come from America, then they would desist. But they think they've got a green light from Trump at the moment, and they think that they can do this, and that's why they've done it. So the Hamas complaint is absolutely valid. It's valid 100 times over. But language is the language that we use in this program. Words mean what they mean. Ceasefire means ceasefire. You stop killing. But in the Israeli parlance, ceasefire means continue the killing in a particular way, and you'll get away with it. And violation of the agreement, they will never accept that they violated the agreement. But for them, Golda Meir and Ben Gurion from the very beginning said that the only constraint on the expansion of Israel was the balance of power at a particular moment, and that what they said, Jews, i.e. Zionist Jews, will occupy whatever they want when they want. That's what we are seeing now in real time.
Indeed. Well, Reza, Mick just pointed out the fact that the Yellow Line Declaration was a huge bridge. How significant do you believe this declaration is as a proof of Israel's non-compliance with the ceasefire?
I mean, Israel doesn't need evidence to prove that it's non-compliance with any ceasefire. But in this case, the fact that they are occupying an occupied land, so in the sense that Gaza itself was previously occupied, they withdrew from it, and now they're occupying it again, and they're using this occupation as a method to cleanse the area that they've occupied, which is called the Yellow Area, and push the remaining Palestinians into the area which is not fertile. The land, the Yellow Area that they are occupying, is the most fertile part of Gaza, and they're trying to starve the Palestinians slowly, or kill them, or shoot them, or have them put onto flights, taken away to different parts of the world, or pushed into Egypt, or wherever they can. So for them, the process, the aim is to cleanse that area of Palestinians. The process has changed. Before, it was a year or two of complete bombing and snipering and killing and burying alive people, Palestinians. Now it's on a slower pace. It's like as if someone's cooking something, instead of trying to get it done quickly in the microwave, they put it on a slow cook. So the Israelis have, and the only pressure that they understand is the pressure of force. And without America, with America's support and European support, it's very difficult for them to realize, for any country to put pressure on them to abide by any ceasefire.
Right, Mick, the most obvious result of any ceasefire must be, of course, a cease of fire. And a cessation of killings is something the least that any party needs to be able to count on. But what should Hamas do right now? Should Hamas be looking for a ceasefire within a ceasefire? You know, doesn't this make the entire deal so ridiculous?
Hamas are in a very difficult situation. The Israelis certainly started the spike in genocide 2 years ago by saying that they would drive Hamas out of the whole of Gaza. Hamas would be obliterated and destroyed. That hasn't happened. But the overwhelming power, the 2,000-pound bombs that Israel can drop on Gaza, the equivalent of all the atom bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and more, means that Hamas has suffered terribly. Now, every colonial struggle, anti-colonial struggle, the people fighting suffer terribly. But in this occasion, it's really almost without precedent in the history of the human race. So Hamas is in a very, very difficult situation. They don't have allies in many of the Arab countries across the region. They're in Trump's pocket, and some of them are working with Israel under the table. So they're very vulnerable. The only hope that Hamas have, I mean, their courage, their determination. I'm saying things which in Britain will get me arrested, but who cares? The courage and heroism of the Palestinian resistance, specifically of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, is almost without equal in human history as well. But they are now alone. Hezbollah has been weakened in Lebanon. They're still fighting. Israel hasn't won the fight, but they have weakened the opposition. So they don't have a lot of choices. I think they have to accept some kind of ceasefire. But really, they have to hold on until a wave of resistance comes to their support. And that means across the region and across the whole world, including America, Britain, Europe, and so on. Our own government is jailing thousands of people or charging thousands of people with terrorism for trying to support the Palestinians. It's a fight now between worldwide public opinion, which can it be channeled in time, and the disappearance of the Palestinians, abandoned by the collective West and by many of these Arab regimes. They don't have a lot of options.
Right, Reza. The other demand from phase one was, of course, the opening of the crossings. I think it was yesterday or the day before that the Israelis said, we are willing to open the Rafah crossing only for the Palestinians to exit the territory with no return. So, you know, how could this happen under a ceasefire? What are the mediators doing right now?
Well, this just supports my argument that this is a slow ethnic cleansing compared to the faster ethnic cleansing before the ceasefire. And my colleague in Scotland, he just demonstrated that the fact that you are not able to condemn the genociders and praise or support those resisting genocide in a free democratic country explains why they're able to close the Rafah border, why they're able to kill people, innocent people, without any fear of justice. You have a prime minister, for goodness sake, who has a court order against him that needs to be brought to the International Court of Justice, and he's going around the world and doing what he wants. I mean, when you have some that situation like that, they can do whatever, they're literally doing whatever they want. They close the Rafah border, they'll kill anyone that goes into the sea, into the Mediterranean from the Gaza, bury people alive. They don't allow journalists in. They're the third, three years in a row now, the most killers of journalists is Israel. But no one's talking about this in Western media. The narrative doesn't come out. No one in Western legacy media discusses it. We have to discuss it on Press TV. We have to discuss it maybe on RT or the podcasts which are resisting the legacy media. So the fact that the politics and the media support the ethnic cleansing, they're able to get away with closing the Rafah border and other crimes, war crimes?
Well, of course, Mick, the human situation is indeed grave in Gaza right now, all over Palestine. Do you believe that now humanitarian guarantees should be prioritized over political negotiations in any future negotiation?
I think in Gaza and Palestine, and really in any consideration, humanitarian and political considerations are inseparable, because the only way that humanitarian aid will reach the violated people of Gaza is by a political pressure coming through Western governments, from public opinion, and also Arab populations as well, to make their feelings known, to demand that humanitarian aid be allowed through. There's no doubt at all that if the pressure is great enough, the aid will go through. But it's a political issue, and it can only be resolved in the short term politically and in the long term politically as well. Look, Gaza, I read a few months ago, Gaza has the highest rate of child amputees, not just in war, but in human history. The gravity of the situation defies our ability to find the language to describe it, but facts like that help. The merciless barbarism of the Israelis filming their own crimes is a level of impunity that we didn't even see in Vietnam or Algeria or anywhere else. So the impunity stems from the fact that Western governments ally actively with Israel and against any notion of Palestinian freedom and justice and human rights. I mean, we've never seen an example. We've seen terrible crimes committed by the collective West for the last 500 years, genocide after genocide, huge genocides, bigger than the current one. What we haven't seen is this happening in the public view, and Western governments, knowing that public opinion is opposed to this, nonetheless pushing the sale of arms and diplomatic protection to Netanyahu and the genocidal state. That impunity comes down to grassroots level in the Israeli army, and that's why they feel able to film themselves committing these terrible crimes. So if you think about it, one other thing, the late unlamented humanitarian foundation, which the Americans and the Israelis forced, that was run by a substantial part by a motorcycle gang. Really, motorcycle gang members were recruited in America at a very high daily rate and sent to snipe Palestinians queuing up for food and bread. That level of impunity is what needs to be tackled, and it's a fight between not just the heroic resistance of Palestine against the Zionist project, but all around the world it's a fight between public opinion and pro-Israeli governments.
Right, Reza, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of the US here. The US, of course, played a lot of publicity and propaganda over the peace deal with the Cairo summit and everything. And at the same time, now President Trump seems to be a little detached from reality when commenting on the situation here, always talking of a wonderful peace that is holding in Gaza. What is the responsibility of the US right now in all of this?
Well, the United States is led by a president who has the attention of a five-year-old. It was at that time it suited him to show that he's brought this peace for the Palestinians. And then once he got what he wanted, the media narrative spin on it, he's moved on to something else. He's focused on Venezuela. Now he's trying to bring some kind of a peace in between Ukraine and Russia. And he jumps to different things. There's no doubt that this President Trump has been the most supportive of the genocidal attempts by Israel. And there's no doubt that, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said many times, that Israel is not a state like normal other states. It's a colonial outpost for the United States and the European. When you look at the ethnic makeup of these Israelis that live there, majority of them come from Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and the United States, and countries like this. So America, it's part of the American policy to support Israel as much as possible. And that's why it's going to be very difficult to get peace. However, I do want to make a point that my colleague Mick raised in Scotland. if the Arabs and the countries around Israel, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and these other countries stop supporting directly and indirectly Israel, it would make the task of the resistance much easier to defend themselves.
Right, and one final question, Mick. Of course, as you said, the situation is very precarious right now. Do you believe external mediators can now bridge the gap between Hamas's demands and the Israeli stance?
That doesn't depend on what's written on paper, because if that were to be enforced, then the Hamas minimal positions would be met, and they would have the possibility of a stable ceasefire. What needs to be done in order to bridge the gap is pressure needs to be put on Israel. If Trump picked up the phone and said, I want my Nobel Peace Prize, I demand that you commit to X, Y, and Z, it would happen. Netanyahu could not possibly stand against Trump. We saw that a few months ago when he did want his Nobel Peace Prize. And when Netanyahu went to Washington and sat beside Donald Trump, I watched that scene and I thought, really, he should have been sitting on Donald Trump's knee, because it was quite clear what the power relationship was between the two. And that's still the case if America or even Europe decided to vigorously challenge Israel. Then a real ceasefire could be achieved. But at the moment, all that Netanyahu sees is a bright green light to carry on with everything that he's been doing for 2 years. I mean, we have to remind ourselves what he's been doing for 2 years. It's unspeakable, and that tells us all we need to know about the current situation. The threat of sanctions from the governments need to be raised against Israel in order for them to be brought to heel. They're an attack dog for the West, and an attack dog sometimes bites its master, but ultimately the master has the power if they choose to use it.
It was indeed a pleasure to talk to you, gentlemen, and I wish I could continue the conversation with you for longer, but for the timing purposes, we have to end this right now. Reza Vedari, academic researcher and author, joining us from London, and Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Glasgow. And one final comment: the truth will always come out, whether you stand with it or not is what really matters. I am Bahman Ray.
Silence, cut like a the ground. No, they can hold me down. See me rising up from the
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. And as history is a testament, and furthermore both friend and enemy have testified openly, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not tainted with any vices, unlike so many others who surrounded him and opposed him. He had a perfect faith in Allah, and so he acted according to his belief. Imam Ali alayhi salam was a lantern of guidance in his time, where the sunnah of the Holy Prophet had begun to be forgotten. Yet Imam Ali remained steadfast on the path of the pure Muhammadan Islam, like a solid, unshakable fortress in the middle of a great wild storm.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام لا خير في الصمت عن الحكم كما أنه لا خير في القول بالجهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "There is no advantage in keeping quiet about an issue of wisdom, just as there is no good in speaking out an unintelligent thing." Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So it is a humble honor to be here at your service speaking about the universal persona of His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So there's something that's really interesting about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, a persona, of course, which transcends time and place. And of course, this is because of the connection that Imam Ali alayhi salam had and has with the Almighty Allah. And so when you become close, or you become one to the ultimate source of time and place, then, well, you become transcendental in that very amazing way that Imam Ali alayhi salam is. Otherwise, how many countless people are lost in the pages of history? Nobody knows anything about them. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, well over 1,000 years have passed, and he seems to be more alive today than ever before. And as we move into the future, he seems to become even more alive and more practical for the world in the modern day. So we find one of the very interesting things about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is the kind of lifestyle that he lived. Now, of course, there's multiple various dimensions when it comes to the lifestyle of His Eminence, but, you know, we only really want to primarily focus on the kind of a house that Imam Ali alayhi salam had. So when he was in the holy city of Mecca, he first used to live with his father in his father's house. After that, he moved in to the house of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him. Eventually, when they migrated to the holy city of Medina, the Holy Prophet built a house for His Eminence next to the Prophet's mosque and close to the house of the Holy Prophet. And then it's interesting that when Imam Ali alayhi salam eventually moved to the city of Kufa, and he made the city of Kufa the capital of the Muslim Ummah for various reasons, he did not stay in the famous palace, which was known as Qasr al-Imara, which was built to be the headquarters of the governance in that place. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam replied, he said that, "I will never reside in this palace of the insane ones." And so for a short time he lived in his nephew's house, and then he built a mud house for himself in the city of Kufa. So, you know, when he was married to Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, and they lived in the city of Medina together, and then when he lived in the city of Kufa as well, we find that it was a very simple life, a very simple home. It wasn't full of luxurious items. It wasn't full of perhaps even some basic items. But this lifestyle, even though it was very simple, it was very blessed. It was very happy. It was very honorable. It was very respected. It was very glorified. And that's something that we need to learn in the present day, is that peace of mind and tranquility and honor and respect, these things do not come about by material things or the things that we have in our homes or the gadgets or whatever it is that we want to have in our homes. Peace and tranquility and honor and respect and you know, peace of mind, really, serenity that we're all looking for, it comes about by living a simple life, but living a life that we are content and satisfied with what the Almighty Allah has provided us, and of course with the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. A very beautiful lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'a.
واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 3 of the Quran in verse number 33 makes an announcement where he says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ اصْطَفَى. Verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh and then the family of Abraham and then Imran عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. As far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him in conveying His message, they are at a higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. You know, most around the world are sacred. And one of the important rulings is that you are not allowed to make the mosque area impure, you know, to allow any najasat, impurity, physical impurity to come in that area of the mosque. And this is such an important issue that suppose you come in a mosque, and you realize that there is an area in the mosque which has become najis, impure. And you still have enough time to purify that area and do your prayers in time. What does Islam say? You're actually not allowed to do the prayers first. Your duty is first to purify that area in the mosque so that the sanctity of the mosque is maintained. Once you have purified it, then you go and do your prayers. And so this is where we come to realize that when it comes to mosque and purity, you know, these two issues are very, very important. Now, for example, a man and a woman who is in state of najasat, impurity, and if they have not yet gone to do their ablution, their ghusl, the shower, then they are not allowed to enter into a mosque in the state of impurity. That's again because of the sacredness of the mosque. However, if a mosque has two doors, two opposite sides, for example, then a person who is in the state of impurity is allowed to pass through. He can enter from one door and exit from another. Suppose he came, you know, he forgot something in the mosque, he knows where it is, but now he is in a state of impurity, he has never yet taken his shower, but he wants to go and retrieve his item.
He can do that by coming from one end door, pick up his thing, and then quickly go out from the other door. And this is based on the verse from the Quran in chapter 4, verse number 43, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَقْرَبُوا الصَّلَاةُ وَأَنْتُمْ سُكَارَى حَتَّى تَعْلَمُوا مَا تَقُولُونَ. And then the verse goes on, وَلَا جُنُوبًا إِلَّا عَابِرِ سَبِيلٍ حَتَّى تَغْتَسِلُوا. Where, the verse, the holy book says that you are not allowed, all you who believe, you are not allowed to enter the mosque in the state of ritual impurity except while passing through until you have washed yourself. When this ruling came in, the way the mosque of the Prophet in Medina was built, it was built in such a way that the house of the Prophet, the house of Ali and the Prophet's the son-in-law and his daughter, as well as the houses of some other relatives, including his uncles Hamza and Abbas, as well as some prominent companions, they had their houses built by the mosque in such a way that their main door going out or in would open inside the mosque. You know, sometimes you get these advertisements from the pilgrim groups. They say, oh, our hotel is so close to the mosque. You just come outside, you are in the mosque. Something like that. But that's just advertisement anyway. But during the days of the Prophet, the mosque initially was built in that way, that his house, his daughter's house, some other relatives and the companions, their house was such that when they come out, they actually come inside the mosque. Now, this ruling that if you are in the state of physical impurity, you cannot enter Masjid al-Nabi became a problem. And so what did the Prophet do? He announced, all these doors opening inside the mosque be closed. And the people who live in these houses, they will have to open another new door on the other side, on the street. Except my door and the door of Ali. Somebody can say, Ya Rasulullah, what is going on? You know, the rule is for everyone. Why make an exception for your door and for the door of Ali and Fatima? Well, this is where the Prophet wanted the Muslims to know that do not consider the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, to be same as yourself.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Radio. you
two.
Two men. Yani?
Bazaar.
Plants grow and give fruits and flowers when they are in the most ideal circumstances. Proper amount of sun, water, soil conditions, and the right temperature are all the ingredients for a happy plant to grow and do what it does best. These days, being a successful farmer is a much more complicated and demanding profession than in the past. Farmers today not only need to have great agricultural skills, but they also must have exceptional technological and marketing expertise. And the most recent trend in farming are greenhouses.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. In this program, we will explore new developments in Iran's vast agriculture industry while shining the spotlight on greenhouses. We wanted to see what all the fanfare is about with this type of farming. Plus, we will also check out how it's making profits in the agriculture sector. So plant yourself in a comfortable seat and let's start the show.
Our journey began at Farakish the Parsian. This company has been around for decades and has a rich history of activity in livestock rearing and farming. Some years ago, it launched a new business specializing in high-tech hydroponic greenhouses. It's an indoor farm with greenhouses built on many hectares of land. Mainly, it grows three types of produce and a variety of tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce. Each year, it may focus on growing a single type of crop, such as peppers. They have perfected Mother Nature indoors through a combination of science and technology married with farming. The goal is to provide sustainable indoor farming solutions that optimize the use of natural resources. Hydroponic greenhouses grow crops in nutrient-rich water, so water management is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce. And they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops, such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training, which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility, which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult. As you might know, open land farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spells, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. The agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also is a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials. The Ministry of Agriculture defined several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few. Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was barely impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing, promotion, and distribution. Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
In a world where our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones. We transfer money, we call our friends, and we do our shopping using these two magic numbers that form the foundation of the virtual yet real world that's called IT. Today, I'll walk you around this Iranian company